This podcast is brought to you by BetterHelp. Welcome to Beg to Differ, the Bulwark's weekly roundtable discussion featuring civil conversation across the political spectrum. We range from center-left to center-right. I'm Mona Charon, policy editor at the Bulwark and syndicated columnist, and I am joined by our regulars, Bill Galston of the Brookings Institution and the Wall Street Journal, Damon Linker, who writes the Substack newsletter Notes from the Middle Ground. Linda Chavez is off this week, but our special guest is Matt Bennett of Third Way. Welcome, gentlemen all. All right. I'd like to start our conversation this week about third parties in general. Matt, the last time you were with us, we talked quite a bit about no labels and the potential spoiler effect that no labels might have in the general election. Our own Bill Galston was a person who was involved in the creation of no labels, but then broke with them over that issue. Since we last spoke, a number of things have happened. First of all, they cannot seem to find a candidate to agree to run on their platform. And the other thing is that Joe Lieberman, who was one of the leaders of that effort, has sadly passed away. So tell us where things stand with no labels, and then we'll get into the other third parties after that.
On the question of where do things stand with no labels, we don't really know. No labels is a kind of bizarrely secretive organization. They, of course, don't reveal who their donors are, and they don't reveal their processes internally or otherwise. They haven't revealed how they've picked the people they call delegates. They say they have 800 delegates. We don't know who they are. The meetings with their delegates are secret. And in particular, we don't know their process for choosing a nominee. They have made a lot of noise about how they're bringing small d democracy to this process. But in fact, their nominee is being chosen by a small group of elites who run no labels. And lately, they have stopped talking to reporters about this. I've heard this from half a dozen reporters that their calls aren't being returned anymore. In part, that's because, as you noted at the outset, a lot of people have said no to no labels. They have offered their ballot line to at least two dozen people that we know of, most of them former governors, people like that, but they include people further afield like Condoleezza Rice and The Rock and a whole host of folks. They even offered their presidential ballot line to Jeff Duncan. And this is the second most famous Jeff Duncan in politics. The first most famous, as everyone undoubtedly knows, is a member of Congress. The second most famous Jeff Duncan is a former one-term lieutenant governor of Georgia. It's that guy that they were going to nominate for president, and he said no. But then most famously,
He is a good guy, by the way. I've heard that from others.
Paul Begala said, oh, Jeff Duncan's a great guy because he's on CNN. And look, I applaud Jeff Duncan for saying no to this ridiculous enterprise. However, the last person publicly to say no, and he did it very publicly in an interview in the Washington Post on the very day that Joe Lieberman passed away, is Chris Christie. And Christie was very clear. He looked at this very hard. He did a poll checking to see whether he could be competitive in a 3-, 4-, or 5-way race. And the answer was absolutely not. And so he bowed out very wisely. And we're hoping that others will follow his lead, but we don't know for sure.
Right, right, right. So Joe Manchin, Larry Hogan, a whole bunch of people have turned them down. So we don't know where that's going. Do you know how many ballots they succeeded in getting?
Yeah, at the moment they're on 19 ballots, including at least four battleground states, Wisconsin, which is the latest battleground, Nevada, North Carolina, and Arizona, and then 15 other states. They claim to be gathering signatures in roughly another dozen. And then there's a bunch of states where they can't yet gather signatures because either the state law doesn't allow it yet or because they don't have candidates. And so they're under the gun now. They had said that they were going to pick a candidate around Super Tuesday. That's now a month ago. In New York, they cannot start gathering signatures until the 16th of this month, of April, and they have to have named their ticket by then. and they only have a short window to gather 45,000 signatures. So that's a real problem for them. And if they claim, as they do, that they're in this to win the election, which is laughable for a million reasons, not being on the ballot in New York is kind of a problem. So we feel like the window's closing rapidly for them to make a decision.
Okay. But that's not the whole story regarding third parties. In this election, we have a significant chunk of the electorate that are the so-called double haters, people who are dismayed by the prospect of either Trump or Biden. And a lot of those people are casting their lonely eyes at the moment on Robert F. Kennedy Jr. He is just on one ballot, as I understand it, Utah. But what's your analysis of where things stand with him?
I think he's also on in Hawaii, so he's racing forward with two giant states, Hawaii and Utah. Look, our analysis is that he is likely to be on the ballot in most or all states because, as you say, he has gotten a lot of attention. His name is Robert F. Kennedy Jr. That is the reason for most of his attention. And he has brought to the ticket, his vice presidential running mate is somebody with absolutely no discernible qualifications to be vice president, other than she is over the age of 35 and born in the United States, Nicole Shanahan. Her huge advantage that she brings is that she was married to somebody who has $120 billion. She was married to Sergey Brin. And unless she has a very bad divorce lawyer, she is very wealthy. And what that means is that her money is what we call in politics hard money. Candidates can spend unlimited amounts in federal races on their own election. And she's a candidate. So all the money she brings can be spent on things like ballot access, which if she wasn't on the ticket and a relative pauper was in that slot, they'd have to raise that from other people in, you know, $3,300 increments. And that's very hard to do.
Right. And you need to raise money because you need to hire the people to get the signatures to get on ballots, right?
Right. You don't have to hire them. Ross Perot was on 50 ballots that, and he got there with volunteers because that was a grassroots effort that had a lot of excitement behind him. I guess it's conceivable that Kennedy could do that, but those signatures are a lot less reliable and it takes a long time to organize volunteers that way. There's no evidence that the Kennedy campaign has that kind of organizational prowess. I mean, Kennedy's campaign manager, it was Dennis Kucinich. He quit the campaign. He replaced Kucinich with his daughter-in-law, and she hired her nanny to be the chief of staff of the campaign. So let's just say it isn't the A-team running the Kennedy campaign, and they've got a pretty long road to hoe to get on those ballots, so they probably have to hire people to do it.
Bill, what's your sense of, so when Kennedy's name first came up last year, there was a sense that he would hurt Biden because he comes from a famous family of Democrats. But then people said, oh, wait, he's a vaccine denier. His specialty is disinformation and misinformation. Therefore, maybe he'll take votes from Trump. What's your sense of it?
Well, he has some high-profile issues, which would seem to overlap with Trump's pretty substantially. So you might say that, but it is very difficult to describe the eclectic coalition of support that he's put together, because you know one of his great emphases is on health as he understands it. And so there are all these weird sort of health spinoffs, and you know, so he has some agricultural proposals that are very attractive to a certain portion of the green left. He's put out a proposal for 3% mortgages for first-time home buyers, which is not the silliest idea I've ever heard, by the way, which is very appealing to young people trying to get started. So there is no ideological consistency whatsoever to the coalition. It's a coalition of discontent, but there's plenty of discontent to go around in the country. And You know, and he appears to be speaking a kind of language that is attractive to a bunch of people who are totally disenchanted with the status quo, with politics as usual, with politicians, with the two parties, you name it. And as Matt said, when you add his name to that cocktail, you have a beverage that a lot of people are finding to be potable. I personally believe that when the dust settles on election day, there's going to be the highest share of non-major party candidates, you know, receiving votes since probably 1996, when Perot got 8% and others got about another 2%. And as we saw in 2016, when the non-major party vote total was just 6%, that was more than enough to skew the results. So this time, when people are polling not just three-way races, but a five-way race, and if No Labels comes up with a candidate, they'll have to do six-way races, the analytical landscape gets very, very complicated. But I'm pretty sure that out of that entire crop, RFK Jr. is going to get more non-major party votes than anyone else.
Damon, people, when they look at his support, have a tendency to say, well, people don't really know what he stands for. If they knew his crazy views, his support would be nowhere near the levels that we're seeing, you know, 10% of the electorate or something like that. But, you know, we don't live in the world of sanity in politics anymore. We live in a world where tens of millions of Americans are happy to say that they want to see Donald Trump back in the Oval Office. And so I'm wondering what you think about whether people just don't care that RFK Jr. says things like, you know, he was the big propagator of the myth that vaccines contained microchips designed by Bill Gates to put in your body. He thinks that vaccines cause autism, and he propounds that myth. He has engaged in some really gross ethnic and religious stereotypes, saying that the virus that causes COVID was designed to exclude Asians and Jews. He is a nut. He believes that his father was not killed by Sirhan Sirhan, who confessed, but by the CIA, on and on and on. He is like the, you know, embarrassing relative at the table at Thanksgiving that nobody wants to hear talk. But I don't know. So what do you think? Yeah, another one. So what do you think, Damon? Do you think they know and don't mind? Or do you think that once people are more familiar, as they will be because Joe Biden has a pile of money? And by the way, Donald Trump has started to attack RFK Jr. too. He calls him a communist, or words to that effect.
Sounds about right for our moment of politics. I would say I agree with you that RFK Jr. cannot win the presidency. But I am very worried about him and what he's going to do to Joe Biden. To start at one random place, perhaps, Gallup released its longstanding survey in January measuring satisfaction with the way things are going in the U.S. The result was that 79% of Americans say they are dissatisfied with the way the country is going. That is a huge portion of the electorate. There's pretty much nothing else where you can get almost 4 out of 5 Americans to agree about something in our time. And he has that very large pool of people to draw on. I urge you, everyone here and everyone listening to this podcast, to take a listen to a video that RFK put out on the night of the State of the Union, where he gave kind of his alternative State of the Union. It was obviously done before he heard the speech of Biden, so it doesn't directly respond to Biden. But it is about, I think it's 9 minutes long. It is extremely compelling. It is 3 to 4 minutes of pure mainline into my veins nostalgia for mid-20th century American greatness. Everything we did, everything the government accomplished, we went to the moon, civil rights triumphed, all this stuff. It's like straight out of something from like a Ronald Reagan speech. And then he pivots to the present, and it is an endless litany of everything that has gone wrong, from the Iraq War to the response to COVID to withdrawal from Afghanistan to surging rates of everything from obesity to mental illness, suicide, addiction. And what does he propose to respond to any of this? Nothing. But it doesn't matter. He doesn't need to win the presidency. But could he win 10% of the vote by giving that message over and over and over again, that these two guys, Trump at least, this now I'm speaking as Kennedy on a debate stage, Trump at least recognizes all of this as a problem. But he's a lunatic who you can't trust to get anything done to fix it. And this guy, Biden, is implicated in all of it. And I am left here as the one man who's standing up to tell you the truth about how broken the country is. That message, I think, will resonate. And I, again, not to win, but to pull Biden down such that we end up with a, you know, I could totally see, like I saw a poll the other day from Arizona, a swing state poll, and it had, I believe it had Trump at like 39%, Biden at 34, and RFK in the high single digits. I could totally see that as a national result.
Okay. So it seems to me that the question is, who will he pull votes from? Now, I haven't seen the video that you mentioned, but it sounds from your description as if that appeal is not going to peel away people who were going to vote for Biden. It's going to peel away, maybe, people who are going to vote for Trump, although I'm not even convinced that anybody who's planning to vote for Trump can be peeled off Trump because they love him. And you know, why would you vote for Robert F. Kennedy when you can have the real thing in Trump? So I
could I just briefly just
yeah,
say
please.
My answer to that question yeah. is he's going to peel away low information voters who are generally disgusted by all of them. And some of them will come from the Democratic Party. Some will come from the Republicans, not Trump's core, but peripheral people who tend to get folded in to the Republican vote by the time we get to Election Day. So just a few fringy, you know,
okay.
We're talking 3 to 5% maybe from each. And I, because he's a Kennedy, I tend to assume it'll slightly tilt more toward damage to Biden. You know, he does come out of a specific kind of Democratic Party milieu. This is like college town, anti-Vietnam War protester hippies who kind of never left the town and still sort of vote for Democrats, but they're quirky and they don't like vaccines and they distrust science and fluoride might be something by the government. Like, these are not us. This isn't people like us who study politics and talk about it all the time and fixate on it. These are people who are really out there, but they are in the coalitions of the two parties and could be wooed away. That's what I worry about.
Matt, what do you think about that issue? Who he pulls from?
Well, I agree that it is very, very hard to know. I do want to inject one thing. I just got 7,000 texts because No Labels just announced they're not going to run a candidate.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So I apologize for being slightly distracted there for a moment because
oh my gosh.
Everyone on planet Earth just texted me. but
Congratulations.
Yes.
To all of us.
To all yes. of us. I do want to just go back to something you mentioned earlier, Mona. Bill wrote two very, very important columns in the Wall Street Journal about this. I would guess at some personal cost to him, because he put a lot of his heart and soul into that organization when they were doing good things. And so I just want to thank him for his sacrifice there. And there was a big coalition that worked on this, and I think it's really, really good news. However, we still have problems, as yes. you were alluding. And my feeling has always been that anything that divides the anti-Trump coalition is bad. Sarah Longwell insists, and I think she's correct, that this is the anti-Trump, not the pro-Biden coalition. That is for sure the truth. And we have got to keep our eye on that. And we just don't know how the Kennedy thing's going to cut. Bill made this point. And really, when you look at national polling, like, it doesn't mean anything. I mean, what we're talking about are tiny numbers of votes in tiny places. Well, not tiny places, but tiny numbers of
in
places.
In swing states.
So,
yeah.
Right, in swing states. So like Maricopa County and Detroit and Milwaukee. And so are they fitness bros and vax weirdos, or are they people who are just low information voters that like the idea of a Kennedy? You know, he's been going around saying that he has very high poll numbers. And my answer to that is, no, your father has high poll numbers.
Yeah.
You know, like, those aren't yours, dude. Like, those are people who don't know the difference, because they're not political obsessives. Who
yeah, but they vote.
But they definitely vote. And so that's what I worry about.
Yeah. Okay. Well, anything else about the other people in the race? Like, where are we with Jill Stein and who else? Cornel West. I mean, are they still in the picture? And can they pull fractions of the vote?
They are, but I would say there's a couple important things to keep in mind. One is West is not yet on the ballot. I think he may be on in one state, but not in any of the battleground states.
Okay.
And it's not clear to me that he has the organizational or financial wherewithal behind his campaign to do that. As we discussed, it can be hard to do. Mm-hmm. If he does get on in one of the swing states, he's a real problem. Stein is on the ballot in a couple dozen states because the Green Party has ballot access. But one mistake that is certain that the Biden team writ large, meaning the Biden campaign and his allies, will not repeat from 2016 is ignoring people like Jill Stein and Cornel West. We did that in 16. I think it made sense back then, given what we knew then. But in retrospect, horrible error. We will make sure people know that Jill Stein is a Putin puppet. She went and had dinner with him. She's a terrible person. And no one should park a protest vote with Jill Stein. And Cornel West is a completely different thing. There's a lot of folks in the civil rights community that are working to kind of try to convince Dr. West that this is probably not the year to do this. And I just don't know what's going to happen there.
Okay. One more third party question. And that is, the Libertarian Party has gotten on the ballot, I think, in all 50 states in the last like four or five presidential cycles. There has been talk of a Kennedy link up with the Libertarian Party, which would truly be strange bedfellows. But then again, the Libertarians can be a little strange, too. So any insights on that?
Well, not many, because the Libertarians are an odd bunch. But I can tell you this. There was a kind of hostile takeover of the Libertarian Party by a radicalized faction. They are kind of MAGA, but kind of not. Some of them are very anti-Semitic. And they now control the party. The woman who is the national chair is from that. They call it the Mises faction. And they are attracted to RFK because he is famous, and he now his ticket has a lot of money behind it, which I guess they feel is good for their brand. But if you look at RFK's positions on everything other than basically vaccines, he's kind of the opposite of the libertarians. He's a big government liberal. And
Who also, just can I interrupt briefly? He also recommended that the Koch brothers, when there were two, that they be taken to The Hague and put on trial for war crimes. You know, the Koch brothers have basically underwritten every libertarian organization in America.
Founded the Cato Institute. I mean, yeah, it's completely bananas for them to even consider endorsing him. But, you know, money and fame get you a long way
if
in America.
I could just add a couple of things, Mona.
Yeah, sure thing.
First of all, the libertarians, I've noticed, are as capable of political cynicism as any other group. And putting RFK Jr. at the top of their ticket would be the best thing ever to happen to the libertarians as a political force, even if ideologically and programmatically it makes no sense whatsoever. So that's point number one. Point number two, just to illustrate how imponderable the entire situation is when you add the third parties to the mix, let's go back to the survey that I think Damon was alluding to. In the two-way race in Arizona, according to my home newspaper, the Wall Street Journal, Trump has a 5-point edge, 47-42. Now, what happens if you move from the two-way race to the five-way race? Answer, Donald Trump has a 5-point lead in Arizona. But this time, 39-34, Kennedy gets 13%, West 2, Stein 1. So you tell me, from whom is RFK Jr. drawing more votes? And the answer is, I don't care how sharp you are with a pencil. There is no way of figuring this out, and there probably won't be. And I'll add one more thing, you know, based on our experience with Perot. It depends on the question of whom he draws more from, depends on how high a vote total he ends up with. Because if he ends up with half of 13, that half will not be a microcosm of the 13. It will have a different composition. And so we can keep on asking these questions, but I assure you we won't have the answers until Election Day, and perhaps not even then.
Well, and what happens between now and Election Day can affect that,
oh,
obviously.
God knows. I mean, yes, of course. So,
you know, so yeah, I mean, it's going to be up to the campaigns to try to educate people about the things that he has said and done. But yeah, Damon, you wanted to make a comment?
Just a quick comment about Cornel West and whether he's going to be someone to worry about. I agree that if he did win and if he did run and had ballot access, he would be another big worry. But I've been working on actually a piece about a lot of this stuff that hopefully will be out in the next week. And I, as part of doing that, I looked up Cornel West and his campaign. I wanted to see some of his speeches and so forth. It's hard to even find anything. I don't really believe he's running. He's going on trips around the country, one or two a week. He's apparently giving talks in these places, but he doesn't even really post the videos. Like, I couldn't find video of him giving a speech within the last 3 weeks. That is not the behavior of someone who's running for president. I think he likes the buzz around him that he's one of these candidates and he does have a whole bunch of issues he cares about. And I think at this point, he's the prototypical example of a guy who's running in order to get his issues talked about, but he's not gonna last.
Interesting. It reminds me of, I think it was in 2000, I can't remember the exact year, but when Fred Thompson was talked about as the possible Republican candidate that year, and people noted that he too was kind of lazy about doing events and wasn't really putting his heart into it. And somebody came up with the great bon mot. They said, yeah, there was an eerie Lackawanna on his part. All right. Well, let's leave that for this week, and we will move on to another topic. But first, let's hear from the folks at BetterHelp. So how is your social battery right now? Do you feel drained? Do you feel bursting with energy? Think about why that might be. I mean, it is springtime, and some of us are getting out. We're being invited to backyard barbecue grills and we're seeing more of our neighbors. And if that makes you feel great, terrific. But a lot of people get anxious at the idea of being out and socializing more. And if that's your situation, you might want to think about how you could recharge your social batteries. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. It's helpful to learn positive coping skills and how to set boundaries. It empowers you to be the best version of yourself. It isn't just for those who've experienced major trauma or have serious, delusions. No, therapy is for anybody who wants to be a more happy and fulfilled version of themselves. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. You just fill out a brief questionnaire and get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. So find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/begtodiffer today and get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P, .com/begtodiffer. All right. So this week, the Florida Supreme Court came down with a decision that could be highly significant because they did two things at once. One thing that they did was that they held that the right to privacy that is in the Florida Constitution does not cover abortion, and therefore the legislature's enactment of a 6-week abortion ban is constitutional and may go into effect next month, May 1st. They also ruled that the question of whether abortion can be on the ballot as a constitutional amendment is proper and can be voted on in November. And so this sets up Florida, a very important state, as a place where abortion is very much, not only is it going to be on the ballot in November, but between now and then, there are going to be lots and lots of people who are going to experience the effect of a 6-week abortion ban, which, as everyone knows, is, you know, early enough in pregnancy that many or most women don't know they're pregnant at that point. So I'm going to start with you, Matt. What do you think is the significance?
Florida is a hellhole and a swamp for Democrats in American politics, which I loathe with every fiber of my being.
Don't hold back, Matt.
I'm a Gore person. And I have terrible, terrible memories of that night when they announced Florida for us, and I was with Gore. We ran out into the hallway and we were hugging his daughters and we were dancing. And then the whole thing that happened later. And then that happened again in 2004, not quite the same way, but Florida is, I believe, fool's gold for Democrats. It's like, you know, pick your metaphor, Charlie Brown, the football. Every year it looks enticing and then we lose by 6. And I think if we spend a lot of money in Florida because of this abortion decision, we are insane. I hope the Republicans have to spend a lot of money. There are some interesting House races in Florida. There are people there who are out of touch with their constituents, and I think there's places where there's real opportunity. But I do not believe that either Florida or Texas are on the near horizon for Democrats, and I hope that we don't take the bait.
Damon, I see you nodding. I will note that Trump won Florida by 3.3 points in 2020, so not 6, Matt, but
we won that year. Like, you know, in the years we lose, we lose by more.
I hear you. Look, it has been trending very red in recent years, but the fact is that Florida was pretty much the only state in the southern United States where abortion was legal after Dobbs. So it is now going to be the case that it's going to be for anybody who wants to get an abortion, they're going to have to travel from all of the southern states, including South Florida. They're going to have to travel as far north as Virginia or Illinois, up, you know, go west, northwest. So it's, you know, it's significant. And it's also the case, just playing devil's advocate here, in every single election since Dobbs, where abortion has been on the ballot, the pro-choice forces have succeeded, even in red states.
I have a couple things to say on this. One is I was nodding when Matt was talking because I appreciate that kind of what I see as kind of sober calculus about where Democrats are likely to pick things up and not. And I'm skeptical, especially about Texas. And I agree that Florida has been painful many, many times. I don't think it's likely to flip. And I think if Democrats spend a lot of money, they're thinking they're going to win, that would be a mistake. However, Biden has a lot of money in his war chest and Trump absolutely does not and will never, because even if they get more money, he's going to siphon it off to pay for his lawyer bills. And so if you can convince the Trump campaign that they are vulnerable in Florida by making a push and make them have to spend there, even if they don't really have to, but make them fear they have to, that could be an effective kind of mind game to play with the Trump campaign. So that might be worth it. The other thing I would say is I very much remember quite vividly the 2004 campaign and the kind of crowing that you heard from people like Karl Rove about crediting Bush's victory that year to putting on the ballots around, I think, 18 states around the country, gay marriage amendments or anti-gay marriage amendments on state ballots to drive up the voter turnout. And it you know, at least it contributed. I don't know if it was the decisive variable, but it helped to drive turnout for Republicans. If the Democrats can get these kind of ballot initiatives on states around the country, it could make a real difference in making sure not just that, like, yeah, a lot of Democrats, especially women, are exercised about this issue, but it's kind of noisy and there are lots of things going on and it's been a couple of years and maybe they're not remembering how important this issue is. But if it's actually on the ballot at the state level in that same year, that's an extra added incentive to make sure that those motivated voters are motivated enough to show up that morning. So If this rumbling in Florida is a sign of that kind of a strategy, I think it's a very healthy one, and I hope it prevails there and around the country. Even if the Democrats still end up falling short in Florida, it could end up leading to the opposite result in places that are much closer.
Bill, I'd love to hear your reaction to what Matt and Damon both said, but also I want to present this. This will probably force Trump to weigh in. I mean, he is, after all, a resident of Florida. He's going to have to answer whether he's for the 6-week ban or not. He has been very slippery about this and has clearly decided that the abortion issue isn't a winner for Republicans. Might make things a little uncomfortable. What do you think?
Well, a couple of points. First of all, he vociferously rejected the 6-week ban during his competition with DeSantis. And to turn around and embrace it now.
That's true.
Well, for any other person in the universe, I would say it would raise credibility issue. What can I say? Now, to Matt's point, I was a Gore guy too. You know, I feel his pain. As a matter of fact, shame on you for making me relive it. I note the following with some interest. There have been two polls taken in Florida in the past month. Trump was, of course, ahead in both of them, in one case by 6 points, in another case by 7. But interestingly, he was below 50% in both of them. And, you know, I think that the Democrats could make a lot of mischief in Florida. And so if they are awash in cash, I think it would be political malpractice not to play there. On the other hand, you know, remembering back to 2016, they had better make pretty darn sure that the allocation of time and resources to Florida, especially candidate resources, would not come at the expense of states that are much more winnable. Footnote here to North Carolina, which is also a stretch, but not as much of a stretch as Florida. If you look at the party registration figures in Florida and the trends over the past decade, they are disastrous for Democrats. The last time I looked, which was yesterday, I think the Republicans now have a registration edge of nearly 800,000 in Florida.
Just another example of the evils of immigration, because that's all those new residents of Florida, the conservatives who are moving in from out of state.
Well, interestingly, that's a great contrast with North Carolina, where it's more upscale professionals who lean liberal, you know, moving into the Research Triangle, et cetera. So the tectonics in North Carolina are just the opposite of what they are in Florida.
Right.
I don't know whether this is a North Carolina year for Democrats, but I think it's a reasonable prediction, although it's been a will-o'-the-wisp, really, you know, for most of the past 40 or close to 50 years now, that it's not going to be out of reach indefinitely.
Yeah, but this year, I mean, just I'm not a political professional. I tend to focus on policy, not campaigns so much, but it just
you're in the wrong country.
Afraid so. True. Anyway, but like I considering the razor thin margins these days, I would spend all of my money in places like Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and Nevada and places that are swing states and not try for, you know, oh, maybe we could win Florida. Maybe we could win North Carolina, you know, because those are not very unlikely, but unlikely enough. So.
Well, we're agreeing vehemently.
Okay. All right. Thunderous agreement there. All right. Let's talk about a poll that came out this week about what Americans think is important to American identity. And I found that, the reason I wanted to talk about it is that the people who commissioned this poll presented it as good news. Look how much agreement there is about basic American values. And I looked at it and I thought, oh, please, only 21% of American adults think that democracy is the greatest system of government. It also found that a minority of Republicans think that freedom of the press is a key American value. What did you think, Damon, of this survey? Am I reading it
wrong? No, I think the survey is, I mean, it's the kind of thing that we've been talking about and noticing for a long time. I think especially younger Americans are sort of unmoored from the deeper narrative of the last century. I mean, for people of my generation and older, which is pretty much everyone on this podcast, there was a kind of deeply entrenched and accepted story of world history and America's role in that history that sort of begins with roughly the Second World War and America reluctantly joining the fight, coming out of that fight as the preeminent world power, having defeated the Axis powers, hoping that this would be the end of having to engage that powerfully in kind of leading the world, and then only to discover, oh, our sort of allies on the other side, the Soviets, have pushed out Germany into Eastern and then Central Europe, and they're not stopping. They're staying there. They haven't withdrawn. Oh no, are we like now facing another possible war? We're responsible for these war destroyed nations of Western Europe and also Japan. Then there's the Chinese Revolution, and it looks like communism is spreading around the globe, and we're in the Cold War. That story that then culminates in the end of the Soviet Union in the late 80s and the unipolar moment, to quote Charles Krauthammer from the early 90s, Francis Fukuyama, the end of history. Could this be the final stage of government, the most satisfying form of politics imaginable? All of these arguments, some of them too extreme for my taste, too rosy, triumphalist. But you know, when you actually read into things like Fukuyama's great book, you see that it's actually a very nuanced and extremely interesting and compelling book. And but the important point for this context is that it created a narrative in which things sort of made sense, and you had to assimilate events that happened at home and abroad into that story. And I think for young people today who were born after the end of the Cold War, let alone those like my current students today at Penn who were born after 9/11, that is a distant memory that they barely know about from history classes. And they just sort of look out at the world that's been presented to them since the September 11th attacks. And everything's kind of up for grabs. Oh, communism, that sounds interesting. I kind of like that. Like it's all, it's unmoored from actual historical experiences. And I think we do a very poor job of trying to teach those lessons to our kids. And the result is findings from that survey. Now, I'm assuming most of the people on the more depressing side of those answers are younger people. I don't want to sound like an old man yelling at the kids these days, but I do think it's worth saying a little bit, these kids these days, on that issue at least.
Matt, so the Cold War was inspiriting, I would say, for Americans in the sense that it clarified who we were, why our values were important, what we were against. We were against, you know, the, as I think Orwell put it, you know, the boot on the neck of humanity forever, which is what the communist totalitarians were for. And it gave us a sense of self-confidence and a sense of mission and meaning that is very much gone. But even before the Cold War, there was a kind of civic religion in this country, a respect for the founding and for, you know, individual liberty. And there were all of these ideas were American ideas even before the Cold War. And yet these survey results seem to suggest that even such basic ideas as freedom of speech, you know, being essential, an essential American value, it doesn't seem to have the same purchase. Are we not conveying to young people or to the whole society those traditional American virtues?
I think there's no question that we're failing to do that. The thing that strikes me about what Damon said about his students, and I was at Penn in the 80s, is how far we are not only from the Cold War and the kind of object lesson of totalitarian communism, but World War II and the object lesson of totalitarian fascism. And young people have absolutely no lived experience of that. My father was a history professor. I can tell you, like, they have no understanding of history. Bill may remember this. 20 years ago, when Third Way was just being founded, he helped us on a poll that we wanted to do. And we asked an open-ended poll question, what was the Cold War? This was in 2005. And we graded on a curve. So if you said anything that was remotely right, Russia, communist, we graded that as right. 45% of the people in 2005 could utter something correct about the Cold War. So people have no frame of reference for any of this. And they have grown up living in a in, you know, the relative freedoms that we enjoy now with no understanding of how tenuous they can be and how scary it could be to lose them or what that would look like in their lives. And I think in addition to our failure to teach civics and our failure to understand how the American system works, people don't have any idea how bad it could get. And if you look around the world, the rise of right-wing authoritarianism, illiberal democracies like Hungary, it is a terrifying moment for Americans not to understand all that.
What do you think, Bill?
Sure. I hate to be the skunk at the garden party here because, you know, I can give a cultural pessimism speech as well as the next man. But are we talking about the same poll?
Go for it. All right.
Let me just put some results on the table. I assume that we're talking about the poll that AP teamed up with the National Opinion Research Center, NORC.
Correct.
To do. Okay. And I haven't looked at the internals of the poll, but here are some top lines for our joint consideration. You know, the percentage of U.S. adults who say the following is extremely or very important to American identity. Equal protection under the law, 91%. Right to vote, 91%. Freedom of speech, 90%. Right to privacy, 88%. Freedom of religion, 84%. Right of the people to assemble peacefully, 83%. Freedom of the press, 77%. On the press, without breathing hard, I know why there's, you know, I don't even have to look at the internals to know why it's 77 rather than the high 80s or the 90s. But if the criterion is the breakdown of consensus on constitutional essentials, then at least, you know, on the surface, the results of this poll tell the opposite story. So why should I add to my already exaggerated sense of alarm based on this survey? That's my question.
Okay, well, let's talk about the freedom of the press one. You know, and we all know why it's 77 and not 97, and that's because Republicans have grown very disenchanted. But it is one thing to say, I don't like the way we're using our freedom. And it's another thing to say, this freedom is not essential to American life, right? Or is that distinction too fine for a poll?
Look, I mean, if you ask fine-grained questions, you can get fine-grained answers.
Yeah.
The only thing I'm saying is that, you know, I have many reasons for alarm about the state of American constitutional Republican democracy. This poll, I have to say, the delta, the additional alarm is indistinguishable from zero.
Okay. All right. That's good. Good. I like that. Let me just note that there's also a PBS Marist poll. There were a few other organizations in it. Too long to say them all. But anyway, they found that 1 in 5, 20% of Americans say that we may have to resort to violence to get the country back on track. And 41% of Americans overall say that the country is so far off track that it needs a leader willing to break rules. And that was including 56% of Republicans said that. On the other hand, Bill, there's a glimmer of light there. They also asked who was leading in the presidential preference. And guess what? Biden was ahead of Trump in this poll.
Yeah, all I can say, Mona, is that I've been part of a team conducting survey research now for more than a decade. And in the past 5 years, we've asked exactly those questions and gotten exactly those answers.
Yeah.
I'm not going to deny that having helped to create this consensus, but we have a lot to worry about.
Okay.
My only point is that this latest poll doesn't add to the sum of our worries.
Fair enough. I'm glad you begged to differ. All right. Let us finish up with this and have a note now from Miracle Made. Did you know that your temperature at night can have one of the greatest impacts on your sleep quality? If you wake up too hot or too cold, I highly recommend you check out Miracle Made's bed sheets. Inspired by NASA, Miracle Made uses silver-infused fabrics to make temperature-regulated bedding. You can sleep at the perfect temperature all night long. Did you know that traditional bed sheets can harbor more bacteria than a toilet seat? Well, that's gross. So, Miracle Made offers a whole line of self-cleaning, eco-friendly bedding, such as sheets, pillowcases, and comforters that prevent 99% of bacteria and require 3 times less laundering. The self-cooling properties give you better quality sleep, and the self-cleaning quality makes your life easier. It prevents 99.7% of bacterial growth. Also, Miracle Made sheets are luxuriously comfortable without the high price tag of other luxury brands. So go to trymiracle.com/begtodiffer to try Miracle Made sheets today. That is trymiracle.com/begtodiffer. And whether you're buying them for yourself or as a gift for a loved one, if you order today, you can save 40%. If you use our promo, Beg to Differ, at checkout, you'll also get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product that it's backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. So if you aren't 100% satisfied, you'll get a full refund. So trymiraclemade.com/begtodiffer and use that code BEGTODIFFER. And we thank them for sponsoring this podcast. All right, we have come to our final segment, highlight or low light of the week. Damon Linker.
Well, you know, I'm tempted to say that no labels failing to find a candidate is the highlight of my week, but I can't with Matt here.
Can't take it from Matt.
I would never do that, but now it gets mentioned yet again. I'm actually going to go back to a New Yorker piece that ran a little over a week ago on March 27th. Titled Why We Can't Stop Arguing About Whether Trump is a Fascist. There's a new book out that collects essays on different sides of that question titled Did It Happen Here? Scholars debating the F word, if you will, and what the debate itself reveals, not only about Trump, but about contemporary American politics and academic trends. The book itself looks very interesting. There are good people in it. But the piece by Andrew Marantz is actually very nicely done. It's enjoyable, interesting, lots of good quotes in there. And, you know, I've been involved in some of those debates. I think there are very important questions raised on both sides. I think some of the people who contribute to the debate are arguing in questionable faith or have various of their own kind of political axes to grind that undermine some of their points. But they're worth hearing nevertheless. And if listeners are interested in taking a measure of those arguments, I think that New Yorker piece is an excellent place to start. So I highly recommend.
Okay, thank you. Matt Bennett.
Obviously, my highlight is the No Labels decision not to go forward. I think it's all kidding aside. I think it's really hugely important. I applaud them for making this decision. They said from the beginning that if they didn't have a path to victory, they wouldn't proceed. There are people that would have taken their nomination out there, but they chose not to give it to just anybody. And I am grateful that they made that choice.
Amen. Bill Galston.
I should start off by saying that I found both of the advertisements, you know, for today's show, extremely thought-provoking. The promise of self-cleaning sheets is enormously compelling, I must say. And the idea that the path to better health lies through setting boundaries, excellent as well. I'm going to get into big trouble for what I'm about to say, but I am not deterred. You know, this is the new, you know, what the hell, full speed ahead bill on display. And it reminded me, this is New Yorker week, of a New Yorker cartoon that caught my fancy some years ago. You know, two doors in an office building. You know, and the left door said Doctors Without Borders. And the one next to it on the right said Mothers Without Boundaries. And I just love that. Okay, but moving on to my my highlight of the week was written by an author that I'm now very angry at because he wrote exactly the piece that I wanted to write, except he wrote it first. His name is Sean Kennedy. It appears in the City Journal, which is the house organ of the Manhattan Institute. Yes, liberals read the City Journal. And the title of the piece is Build Back Faster. And, you know, its immediate topic is, of course, the Key Bridge. But in talking about the challenge of rebuilding it, Mr. Kennedy offers a number of examples of accelerated reconstruction of important infrastructure collapses, Pennsylvania, Minnesota, and elsewhere. And what it requires above all is a commitment at every level of government to reducing bureaucratic red tape, making decisions not one after the other, but in parallel and quickly, reducing the time needed to approve a major infrastructure project from the multiple years that's typical for the United States to a matter of months. It can be done if the will is there. And I think the rebuilding of the Key Bridge, you know, offers a high profile example of what might happen if there's a will, you know, connecting Baltimore, Maryland, and the federal government to get this done and not to spend year after year on environmental reviews and, you know, and the other sorts of red tape that is clogging up the system. I'm not against environmental reviews, but I am against 10-year approval periods for major infrastructure projects.
Yes, thank you for that. All right. I would like to praise Karl Rove, which is a little unusual for me because I was highly critical of Rove, not when Matt Bennett was critical of him in 2004, but because I was not on the Al Gore team, though I respect the way he handled things very much. But I have noticed, you know, that since Trump came on the scene, Karl Rove was sort of, you know, an anti person. Like, he wasn't pro Trump, but he wasn't anti Trump either. And in 2020, he actually advised Trump's reelection campaign and so forth. And I found that hard to understand, how anybody of good conscience could support Trump's reelection in light of all of the things that he did even before January 6th. But okay, he did that. But the other day, he was on a panel with Ari Melber of MSNBC, who asked him about the way Trump is using January 6th so-called hostages in his campaign appearances, in his rallies. And Karl Rove gave a response that I actually want to praise and I want to play for you all, because it took me aback. I was surprised to hear it coming from Rove, and it is the sort of thing that every Republican should be saying. And so I want to thank Karl Rove for doing it, and here it is.
If they were smart, they'd take the January 6th and go hard at it. And they would say, he wants to pardon these people who attacked our Capitol. I worked in that building as a young man. To me, the Congress of the United States is one of the great examples of the strength of our democracy and a jewel of the Constitution. And what those people did when they violently attacked the Capitol in order to stop a constitutionally mandated meeting of the Congress to accept the results of the Electoral College is a stain on our history. And every one of those sons of who did that, we ought to find them, try them, and send them to jail. And if And one of the critical mistakes made in this campaign is that Donald Trump has now said, I'm going to pardon those people because they're hostages. No, they're not. They're thugs. There were people, some of them had automatic weapons at a hotel in Virginia hoping to be able to be called up. We had people saying, where's Nancy Pelosi? We had people who were, you know, taking desks and sitting at the desk of the Speaker of the House and attempting to, you know, find people in order to bring them to justice and saying yelling at the police, kill them all. And so why Trump has done this is beyond me. If he had said, you know what? I trust our jury system. I trust law enforcement. Anybody who assaulted the Capitol ought to be, I mean, he said it once or twice, but now he's appearing in a video with people who assaulted police officers with an intent to take the Capitol by force. So, you know, look, I'm a Republican. I don't want to have a Democrat president. I want to have a Republican president. But we're facing as a country a decision, and everybody gets to make it, as to what kind of leadership we're going to have. And to me, it is a mistake on the part of the Trump campaign to allow the president's impulses to identify himself with the people who assaulted the Capitol rather than people who stand for law and order. Yeah.
So thank you, Karl Rove. That was very clear. And I'm very, very happy to hear it. And with that, I want to thank Matt Bennett, our guest. I'm so glad we had you on a day when we received this news, Matt. It's a huge coup for you. It really is.
Thank you. It was a team effort and Bill helped.
And yes, Bill too. All right. And then I would like to thank our producer, Jim Swift, and our sound engineer, Jonathan Siri, and our wonderful listeners and viewers. And Make a Difference will return next week, as every week.